ุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิ It seems to happen, I suspect not really, that people embark on this practice, this following these Buddhist teachings, and in particular taking up meditation practice, and with enthusiasm and aspiration and hope, and then reach a point where they feel they're not making progress anymore. And sometimes even feeling chronically obstructed. And if at that point they jump to the conclusion something's going wrong, that's really regrettable. This is normal. It's very normal to reach a point where we feel we can't continue, or we feel obstructed, or we don't know what to do, or what's the next move. Maybe some of you have read or heard about that stage that Ajahn Chah reached in his practice, where he'd been, what he saw, making good progress for a significant period of time, and then reached the stage where he just wasn't making any progress anymore. He talked about like standing on the edge of a cliff. And it turned out, he sought the advice of somebody older and wiser than him, and it turned out that the suffering, the struggle, the dukkha that he was experiencing at that point was because he was used to making progress. He was used to moving forward. And when he reached the point where he didn't feel like he was moving forward anymore, he felt frustrated and was struggling. So I like to talk about this a little bit this evening, because because it's inevitable, we will reach points where we feel challenged or obstructed, sometimes chronically obstructed, with particular patterns of activity, mental activity, emotional activity, moods that we just feel like we can't get past and reoccurring. How do we handle that? How do we meet that? Do we jump to conclusions? And there's something inherently wrong with me. I've got some really bad karma, or I don't have enough good barami, or I'm a complete psychological mess, or whatever language or way we want to frame it. There is another way of looking at it, and I think a more skillful way of looking at it, which is to do with what are we bringing with us into this practice? What have we brought with us from the past? We have aspiration, we have energy, we have enthusiasm, we have faith, which of course is all nice stuff. We also, a lot of us, have an accumulation of what I've referred to many times before as denied dukkha, accumulated denied dukkha, or just plain old denied dukkha. And it can get distorted and manifest in ways that look like this is all too much. This is just intolerable. I can't handle this. The way we react when we have such experience matters a great deal. Just recently I was talking with a friend who'd been practicing for a good number of years, and they were sharing with me how they keep having this experience. It's not so much an obstruction in their meditation, however, it's an experience that is frustrating, and it's to do with a particular motif that whenever they're watching a movie, there's just this one motif, whenever it comes up in whatever form, however it shows up, they always start crying. What's going on there? There's a mature person who pretty capable in all sorts of areas of his life, and yet this one motif, it's actually just like one or two sentences that get said, and always it triggers this, well, I think it's probably safe to call it sadness. And How do we meet these experiences that seem unreasonable, seem excessive, seem too much? If we don't have the right way of thinking about it, if we don't have the right approach, then we can make it worse. It's like, you know, the example I've often given of you have a wound and it's healing and it's itchy. That's what happens when wounds heal and you really want to scratch, And if you have a low level of intelligence, you know, like a dog, you just scratch it and you make it worse. You've seen a dog, if you've seen a dog with the mange, it's very unpleasant to see. They just can't stop scratching. And human beings have this faculty to reflect on, based on previous experience, if I scratch this itch, even though I really want to do, I really, really do want to scratch this itch, if I do, it's going to get worse. And so we choose to inhibit. We use our discernment, we use our reflection, we use our intelligence to inhibit the impulse because of understanding. So if we don't have the right understanding with regards to our experiences of frustration, of limitation, of dukkha, then we can very easily make things worse. So like, for instance, the neighbor's birds that keep screeching, how do we handle that? You know, sitting meditation and enjoying the quietude, and then one or two or three of these birds start screeching. And if you happen to like that particular form of screech, well then it's not an issue for you. If you don't like it, then what happens? What happens when we experience dislike? Does it have to be a problem? Is that bird screeching a problem? Well, there's always been birds around screeching, and there always will be. So is there a way where it's possible to live with birds screeching, or if you live in Thailand, it's dukke. You're sitting in the Dhamma hall in Thailand, the dukke kind of lizard making its noise and disturbing your meditation. Do we have to be disturbed by the things that we dislike? From the Buddha's perspective, no. And so how do we practice with that? Well, what is the nature of being disturbed by the neighbor's birds screeching during our meditation or screeching when we're trying to sleep? What is the dukkha actually? If we don't understand this, then we can miss an opportunity to really develop and practice. You remember the Buddha said, I teach two things. I teach dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. He didn't say, I teach one thing. I teach the cessation of dukkha. Nirodha Satcha, believe in Nirodha Satcha and everything's going to be fine. That's not the Buddha's way. He didn't say there's one. Well, he did say there's one way. Ekayana did talk about one way. That was talking about mindfulness. That's something else. However, he did say, I teach two things, not just Nirodha Satcha, not just liberation as possible, also dukkha. Dukkha and the ending of dukkha. And so this is what we need to be reflecting on, our relationship to dukkha. The way we approach it makes a big difference. Is it necessary, when that bird starts screeching, to have disliking? Can we avoid disliking arising? Again, if you're somebody who likes that noise, then it doesn't apply. If you don't like the noise and disliking arises, do we have to suffer because of disliking? And what happens when disliking arises? That's the point. What happens when disliking arises? If we cling to the disliking, what happens? There's a contraction takes place. The heart becomes obstructed. There's a constriction, a contraction, and then aversion, even hatred. And then if we don't catch it at that point, then that energy goes up into our head and we say, I can't live here, I can't stand this. You know, those birds should be banned. There's something wrong with the neighbor. We've got to do something about it. Spent ages ranting in our heads. What's the alternative? Well, another alternative is that when that bird starts screeching, or those birds start screeching, is to take a deep in breath, open your chest up, create the space, physically creating the space in your chest, and say, yes, welcome. Not welcome to the bird. The bird's just doing its thing. Welcome to what? Welcome to our heart's reaction, which is, if we're suffering, our reaction is one of aversion. It's our heart energy that we're struggling with. That's the issue when something dislikable arises. You can't make ourselves like things that are dislikable. Like, you know, somebody's got smelly socks. You can't like the smell of smelly socks. You can't make yourself like it. And smelly socks are an unpleasant smell. Like, beautiful sounds are beautiful. There are some sounds that are beautiful, some sounds that are ghastly. Some smells are beautiful, some smells are ghastly. Some flavors are beautiful, some flavors are ghastly. That's the sensory realm, that's life. The six senses, sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, and mental impressions. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and cognizing. That's the world we live in. Finding things agreeable or disagreeable, that's inevitable. Reacting and turning it into a greed, hatred, and delusion, that's something else. And so that's what I would encourage reflecting on. Do we have to suffer? Like, for instance, this friend who cries whenever this motif appears in a movie. When we were talking about it, I encouraged him to see it as a key. This is good. This is good. I'm pleased this is happening. As I say, he's not a beginner in practice. He's interested. He's able to work with this stuff. This is what you're in touch with. It's very obvious. You don't have to have studied a lot of psychology to realize that there's some painful incident happened in an early stage of life that wasn't fully met, wasn't received, wasn't allowed, wasn't met, and so got stored away. And so now every time something that approximates that feeling emerges, then the old sadness comes up. And if it happens long enough, it becomes automatic. The automatic reaction is that the sadness arises, and then there's the disliking of the sadness, and then the automatic reaction is to push that down into the belly, which is presumably what happened with the original incident, whatever it was. I talked before about that helpful hint that I received from the local acupuncturist I go to see, where he pointed out that our nervous system as human beings have this facility whereby if there's something that you can't deal with at the time, like he gave the example of a mother who finds her child has been hurt and is struggling and she gets upset. However, she doesn't have time to deal with her upset mood at that point. She's got to look after the child. And so instead, she accesses this facility in her nervous system to park it in the belly, and then she's functional and she can help the child until the child feels okay. And then the smart thing to do is to go back and address that, bring it back up into the feeling center, into the heart, meet it, allow it, receive it until it's been fully received, fully integrated, or fully let go of, however you want to talk about it. Remembering that we're not letting go of the energy of our reaction, we're letting go of our resistance to that energy, letting go of our resistance to the pain. For many of us, for a variety of reasons, not the least being affluence, we have all sorts of opportunities to distract ourselves from the pain of life, from sadness, from frustration. And we push it down into unawareness, and instead of doing the work of meeting it and welcoming it, recognizing it as our heart energy that needs to be received into conscious awareness, we distract ourselves. That's one of the side effects of affluence. Also, the sedentary lifestyle contributes. A lot of people these days live such sedentary lives that they push this pain down to their belly and they're not moving, so it just sits there and gets stuck there. And traditionally, for most of human history, people have been physically working, physically active, and the pain that's down your belly, it gets worked up, it gets received back into the organism, and which is some people maybe the experience when you go jogging or you go climbing or hiking and do some physical exercise, and there can be a psychological and emotional component, something gets activated. Where did that come from? It's something that we had parked in our nervous system because we weren't ready or able at the time to deal with it. And so that way of understanding it can be very helpful. It's not because we're bad or we're stupid or something went wrong. It's just like, this is life. This is, Buddha said it over and over again, this existence is dukkha. If we're not rightly aligned in our being, that means our head, our heart, and our belly, and our all of our being. If we're not rightly aligned, we're not rightly prepared, then when we experience dukkha, we avoid it. It doesn't go away. And so you wonder why you're suffering, and oh, the spiritual teachings of the Buddha, this is going to solve my problems. And so you engage the exercises and meditation and discipline, and the next thing you start finding all these old feelings surfacing. If we're so habitually identified in our heads that we don't even notice that it's the feeling that arises first, well, that could be an added complication, because really the feeling is the fire. The thoughts that we have is just the smoke. Yeah. If we don't meet the pain on the feeling level in our body, in our belly, in our heart, as a raw sensation, if we don't meet it, well, then it is natural that energy goes up into our head and starts spinning around with all sorts of stories. And then we desperately trying to understand, why am I still crying every time this motif appears? Thinking about that might be the initial approach. However, then we need to go deeper and realize this is energy we're dealing with. This is emotional energy. This is feeling. And so the great renunciation is not just giving up eating chocolate or putting sugar in your coffee. Those gestures of renunciation obviously have their benefit. Now, the real renunciation is clinging to that artificial source of security, which for many of us is our ideas about life, our ideas about who we are, our ideas about how to solve life's problems. The ideas, the approximations, absolutely have their place. And we're fortunate that we can educate our ideas and orient ourselves in the right direction. Then we need to renounce that synthetic initial level of security and come down and explore something which can be quite frightening, which is the place where we feel very limited, which is the pain of life, the accumulated denied pain, denied dukkha. So if we can appreciate this, then as I was saying to my friend the other day, something like an habitual pattern arises, and it's a key to the door that you have parked some pain in the past. You weren't ready to deal with it. And this is the key. So don't see this expression of sadness as some sort of an indictment against you. It's an indicator. It's pointing to where to look, where to feel. And it's not just sadness. Recently I had several experiences where I was noticing that there was a struggle in a certain area, and it took quite a while before I came around to realizing, to seeing, oh, that's what's happening there. And there was this particular project that I had my mind set on. I want to do this project. I really want to do this project. And I'd started it and invested some energy in it, and yet it wasn't continuing, it wasn't progressing, and it wasn't going in the direction I wanted to go, it wasn't happening, and I keep going back, I've got to do this project, I've got to pick up this project, I've got to engage this project. It just wasn't happening, until eventually I realized that I was resisting the feeling of disappointment. the pain of disappointment, the dukkha of disappointment. It's that simple. The dukkha of disappointment, if you've been avoiding it for years or decades, as the case may be, or lifetimes, when disappointment arises, there can be, unless you've got a reasonably well-developed sense of sati, of mindfulness, and indriya sanghara, intentional composure or restraint, those faculties are not adequately developed, then you don't see it, you don't catch it, you don't get it. It's normal to deny the dukkha of disappointment. It's not normal to deny the dukkha of disappointment. It's a dysfunction, and it's making us chronically imbalanced, chronically unhappy. And just seeing disappointment and the resistance to disappointment, and then opening up the heart of awareness, and taking a deep breath and create the space physically and metaphorically, reminding ourselves the potential to receive into awareness this dukkha. That's what's called for. And then what happens? It's tolerable. Doesn't mean to say it's nice. And disappointment, it always feels like disappointment. Like lemons, they always taste sour. You bite a lemon, it's always sour. That's the nature of lemons. The nature of conditioned existence is dukkha. If we cling to it, we suffer. So how do we stop clinging? Well, then we've got to pay attention to the consequences of our clinging. And that's again, a message that needs emphasizing. Somebody else was telling me recently how they were locked into this pattern that they had picked up somewhere that had to do with the lack of self-worth. I don't remember all the details now, and they're not really important. The point was that they were suffering from a lack of self-worth, and somebody had been encouraging them in the direction of stating these kind of self-affirming reminders that they're valuable, they're a valued person, or something in that direction, which might have its benefit and it might work. And they asked me how I would approach it, and I said, well, how do you feel about where you're at with this feeling of lack of self-worth? I suspect probably you're not pleased about it. Maybe you're even angry about it. Maybe you're even really angry about it. And I think, if I remember the conversation correctly, they did acknowledge, yeah, they were angry about it. That's where we're at. That's what needs to be received. How do we feel about where we're at with this experience of being stuck? Are we desperately sad about it? That's what needs to be received. Are we angry about it? That's what needs to be received. The difficulty in this approach, or one of the difficulties in this approach, because it's not easy, which is why a lot of people don't do it, but one of the difficulties is that when we turn to, for instance, being honest about the fact that we feel angry about this perception we have, or this predicament we find ourselves in, what we encounter is what I referred to before as the accumulated old stuff. And that, as I said, again, once it's been denied, it can get really turn really weird. It's not easy to understand. Why does this anger seem so overwhelming? Why does this sadness seem overwhelming? Why does this disappointment feel like it's going to crush me? Well, at least start by doubting the assumption that you have, that there's something inherently wrong with you, and try considering, well, this is what happens when dukkha is denied. It returns like this. You push it down and deny it, it goes weird. And then when we meet it, it can be very tricky. And it can appear like it's too much. For some people, something really sad happened at a very tender stage of life, like age 7, lost a parent, the grief that comes from losing a loved one when you're 7 years old. If it's not properly dealt with, what happens to it? It doesn't disappear, it gets buried in unawareness. And sooner or later, it's going to need to be received. And when it's received, there's a very good chance that just as when you were 7 years old, you didn't feel ready to handle it, now at 27, when you're on a meditation retreat, again, you meet it and you don't feel ready to handle it. Don't automatically believe that. Don't disbelieve it. Cautiously open up to it and consider the possibility that the open-hearted awareness, the state of open-hearted awareness, has the capacity to receive this pain, to receive the pain that you're experiencing, which is the resistance to dukkha. And now, as an adult, we don't have to resist it. And in the process of allowing it, in the process of meeting it, whether it's sadness or disappointment or desire, likewise, as a little person, a young person, your parents shame you because you want to eat ice cream, or shame you because you don't want to go to bed, you want to play with your toys, and instead of supporting you and helping you develop a conscious relationship with desire, which of course is a task that all parents have to perform, they shame you into feeling bad about having desires. And not because the parents are necessarily bad, it's just they're not necessarily very wise or aware. And so you develop a habit of denying desire, and then your fundamental relationship with desire is obstructed. And so now, as a 27-year-old, you have this addiction to looking at your smartphone. First thing in the morning, you wake up. I know I shouldn't look at my phone. However, I just have to look at my phone. Do you really have to look at your phone? What's going to happen if you don't look at your phone? Are you going to die? You're not going to die if you don't look. But it can feel like you're going to die. You can feel like you're overwhelmed by, what is it that you're overwhelmed by? It's not your smartphone. I mean, those people who create the algorithms that make you feel like you just have to look at your phone, they know that it's tempting. They give you a little dopamine hit there and you get addicted to it. However, if there's not a backlog of denied desire, then what's the problem? You just feel it. I want to look at my phone. What's the problem with that? Really? I want to look at my phone. It's not a big deal. It's just a little moment of wanting. What's a big deal, or what feels like a big deal, is the backlog of denied, of accumulated, denied desire. Yeah. So whether it's desire or anger or fear, like I can't handle a situation, again, very normal. We deny fear at an early stage of life. It becomes a habituated pattern in our nervous system. The reaction takes place. We don't even know it's happening. It's such a habit. Our breathing changes, and we don't even know that our breathing changes. Our nervous system is adjusted to perform this habit of denial. And when we encounter a manageable moment of fear, here and now, it appears unmanageable. It appears overwhelming. Why? So this is really worth thinking about, really worth considering, because the way it appears, or the way it can appear, is it's too much. Oh, one last example, because I've mentioned it recently, is grief. When the sadness of losing somebody you care about deeply. What's the problem when somebody dies? Particularly if the death was not totally unpredicted. What's going on there? What is the pain, actually? We need to look into this. What is the pain? It's not the person dying that's the pain. It's what? It's not even our disliking of it. Of course, we don't like losing a loved one. What is it? It's our resistance. It's the heart contraction. We close our hearts down to deny the pain and push the reaction down into our belly. And so the practice is how to counter that. Take a deep in-breath. Take a deep in-breath and metaphorically create the space to receive that hurt. Not be afraid of the hurt. Cautiously, of course, gradually, don't be too ambitious, don't give yourself a heart attack in the process, and gently, respectfully, in a considered way, feel the consequences of the heart contraction and counter that with the encouragement to trust. Trust in the heart's capacity to receive all that energy. And noticing that skillful non-resistance, which is what we're talking about, skillful non-resistance is very different from heedless acquiescence. Thank you very much this evening for your attention.